Welcome, everybody, to our deep dive into ancient empires. Today, we're going to be exploring Egypt and Assyria. We'll be uncovering their surprising connections to the biblical world and our guide for this journey. Excerpts from a lecture by Dr. Jeffrey Houdin, an expert on biblical archaeology. Get ready for pharaohs, powerful kings, and even the origins of our alphabet.
Yeah, it's easy to imagine these ancient civilizations as isolated, yeah. You know, but the reality is they were constantly influencing each other. And by understanding those connections, you can unlock a whole new dimension to familiar biblical stories.
OK, so before we jump into Egypt, we need to start with the Canaanites. They were the dominant force in the region before the Israelites, right?
Right.
Dr. Houdin reminds us that they were Semitic people, just like the Israelites, but with a very different belief system. They were polytheistic, meaning they believed in many gods.
That's right. And their culture had a huge impact on the ancient world, especially when you consider that the Canaanites, well, they gave us the alphabet.
Wait, really? The alphabet came from them. I never would have guessed that.
Think about it. Before the alphabet, writing systems like Mesopotamian cuneiform used thousands of symbols. Thousands. The Canaanites simplified it all, using just 30 symbols to represent letters. Dr. Houdin even shared an image of a Ugaritic tablet with this early alphabetic cuneiform. It's appeasing to think that this invention, born in Canaan, literally changed the world. It's why you're listening to this right now.
Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so the Canaanites were clearly pretty innovative. What else were they known for?
Well, their name Canaan actually means merchant, and they were known for their cedar forests, seafaring skills, and vast trading networks that stretched across the Mediterranean. They even established settlements as far west as the Pillars of Hercules, what we know today as the Strait of Gibraltar.
So you're telling me these ancient traders were sailing all over the Mediterranean, bringing goods and ideas from different cultures. I can just picture those ships, you know, laden with goods, navigating by the stars.
It's fascinating to consider how their influence spread throughout the ancient world. And speaking of discoveries, have you heard about the lost city of Ugarit?
Oh, yeah, I think I remember reading something about that. It was discovered by accident, right?
It's a great story. Imagine a Syrian farmer in the 1920s just plowing his field and suddenly uncovering the ruins of a city that had been buried for centuries. You know, it was like something out of an Indiana Jones movie.
That's incredible. What did they find there?
The excavations at Ugarit unearthed palaces, temples, and most importantly, tons of cuneiform tablets. At first, scholars were baffled because the language was unfamiliar. It looked like cuneiform, but with only 30 symbols. Then came the aha moment. They realized it was an alphabetic cuneiform script representing a Canaanite language very similar to Hebrew.
So these tablets were like a window into their world.
Yeah.
Did they help us understand the Bible better?
Absolutely. The Ugaritic texts actually shed light on the Book of Psalms. Scholars have found similar language and poetic structures, which is pretty mind-blowing. Dr. Houdin recommends a book called Stories from Ancient Canaan, if you're interested in exploring this further.
Well, I'll have to check that out. But if the Canaanites were so influential, did they also have a negative impact on the Israelites?
Well, their polytheistic beliefs and practices definitely cause conflict. Remember the story of King Ahab marrying the Phoenician princess Jezebel?
Oh, yeah, Jezebel. She's not exactly known for being a positive influence.
That's right. She brought her Canaanite beliefs and practices to Israel, which led to, you know, a lot of tension and conflict. It's a reminder of the cultural and religious clashes that often happen between the Israelites and their neighbors.
Okay, so we've explored the fascinating world of the Canaanites, their influence on the Israelites, and the incredible discovery of Ugarit. Now, let's turn our attention to one of the most iconic civilizations of the ancient world, Egypt.
Get ready for a journey through millennia of history filled with pyramids, pharaohs, and a civilization that left an indelible mark on the biblical world.
I'm ready. Bring on the pyramids.
Just imagine standing at the foot of the Great Pyramid of Giza, feeling the weight of history all around you. But here's something to consider. Those pyramids were already ancient when Abraham and Sarah visited Egypt. They were 400 to 500 years old by that time.
Seriously? Wow, that puts things into perspective. Egypt has such a long and complex history. I'm always getting confused about the different periods and dynasties.
Well, it's important to remember that Egypt wasn't wasn't a single unified entity for its entire history. It was actually divided into two kingdoms, Upper Egypt in the south and Lower Egypt in the north. It was Pharaoh Narmer who finally united these two kingdoms as symbolized by the double crown.
Ah, so that's where the double crown comes in, is like a symbol of their unification.
Exactly. And of course, we can't talk about Egypt without mentioning the Nile River. It was the lifeline of Egypt, providing the water and fertile land that made life possible in this otherwise arid region.
I've always known the Nile is important, but I never realized just how crucial it was.
Dr. Hunan pointed out that the arable land along the Nile was only about 12 miles wide on either side. Beyond that, it was all desert. Without the Nile, there would be no Egypt. It truly shaped the destiny of this civilization.
It's amazing to think how geography played such a pivotal role. Okay, so let's try to get a handle on the timeline. What were the major periods of Egyptian history?
To simplify, we can break it down into the Old Kingdom, which is the age of the pyramids, followed by intermediate periods of turmoil and instability. Then we have the Middle Kingdom, the New Kingdom, which is when Egypt was at its height, and finally the Late Period.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it. And how do these periods line up with the biblical narrative?
Well, the Middle Kingdom, or Second Intermediate Period, is a possible time frame for the story of Joseph. And the New Kingdom is the time of the Israelite sojourn in Egypt and the Exodus.
That makes sense. But here's something that's always bugged me. The Bible doesn't name the pharaohs who interacted with Abraham, Joseph, or even Solomon. Why is that?
That's one of the enduring mysteries of biblical history. It makes you wonder why these powerful figures are left anonymous.
But isn't it strange the Bible doesn't mention these powerful pharaohs by name?
There are various theories. Some scholars believe it might have been a deliberate choice to emphasize the theological message. For example, in the Exodus story, the pharaoh is deliberately unnamed because his powerlessness against God made him unworthy of being recorded in the biblical narrative. It adds another layer of mystery and intrigue to the story.
That's an interesting point. It makes you think about the different layers of meaning embedded in the text. You know, it's one thing to read about these ancient rulers in the Bible, but it's quite another to imagine actually seeing them face to face.
It definitely sparks the imagination. Have you ever been to Egypt?
Actually, I haven't. But Dr. Hudon mentioned visiting the new museum in Egypt and seeing the mummies of the pharaohs, including potentially the pharaoh of the Exodus. It must have been an incredible experience. I can only imagine standing there looking at the faces of these rulers who played such a pivotal role in biblical history.
It really brings history to life, doesn't it? It makes you realize these were real people who lived, ruled, and ultimately met their end. It's a reminder that even the most powerful figures are not immune to the passage of time.
Okay, so we've talked about the grand sweep of Egyptian history, but let's zoom in a bit and talk about the specific ways that Egyptian culture influenced the Bible.
Excellent point. Egyptian influence is evident in many aspects of the biblical world. You see it in names like Moses, Hophni, and Phinehas, which are all Egyptian in origin. Even some of the Proverbs have close parallels to Egyptian writings. And then there's the visual evidence.
Oh, right. What about that 12th dynasty tomb painting you mentioned earlier, the one that shows Asiatics bringing goods to Egypt?
Exactly. The people in that painting have distinctive hairstyles, beards, light skin, and colorful clothes. It immediately makes you think of Joseph and his famous coat of many colors.
And the coolest part, that tomb dates back to the patriarchal period, giving us a glimpse of what Abraham and Sarah might have actually looked like. It's like a visual time capsule.
It's incredible how archaeology can bring the Bible to life in such unexpected ways. And speaking of bringing things to life, we can't forget about the Hyksos, those Asiatic rulers who controlled Lower Egypt for about a century during the Second Intermediate period.
Oh, yeah, the Hyksos. Weren't they the ones who ruled from Everest?
That's right. Remember that vizier's tomb and the destroyed statue found at Everest? Some speculate it could even be Joseph's tomb.
Hold on. We're talking about a potential tomb of the biblical Joseph. That's huge.
It's certainly an intriguing possibility, and there's more. We have the store cities of Pithom and Ramses, built by the Israelites, providing tangible archaeological evidence of their presence in Egypt. Plus, there's the potential face of Thutmose III, a likely candidate for the pharaoh of the Exodus. It's like assembling a historical jigsaw puzzle, one discovery at a time.
It's amazing how these discoveries keep adding to our understanding of the past. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground with Egypt. Now I'm ready for something totally different. Let's meet Akhenaten, the heretic pharaoh.
Get ready for a fascinating character. Akhenaten rejected the traditional Egyptian gods and worshipped only Ateten, the sun god. Can you imagine the audacity? A pharaoh considered a god himself, rejecting the entire pantheon of Egyptian deities and embracing a single god.
This focus on a single god brings us to another fascinating figure. Tell me more about Akhenaten.
It was a radical departure from tradition. He even built a new capital city, Amarna, aligning it with the rising and setting sun. Talk about dedication. Dr. Houdon showed an image of Akhenaten and Nefertiti with their children basking in the rays of the Aten. It was a completely new style of art, and it really captures the essence of Akhenaten's religious revolution.
It makes you wonder if Akhenaten got the idea of monotheism from the Hebrews.
That's a question that has been debated for years. It's certainly possible, given the interactions between Egypt and the surrounding regions, but we may never know for sure.
It's like one of those historical mysteries that will probably never be fully solved. But even if we don't know the answer, it's still fascinating to think about the possibilities.
Absolutely. And speaking of fascinating discoveries, we can't forget about the Amarna letters.
Hold on. We can actually read their mail. What kind of things did these kings write about?
Imagine stumbling upon the ancient equivalent of a diplomatic email archive. That's essentially what the Amarna letters are. They were found in the ruins of Akhenaten's capital and contain diplomatic correspondence between Egypt and its vassal kings in Canaan. These letters are written on clay tablets and give us an incredible glimpse into the political situation in Canaan during the period of the Exodus and conquest. There are even letters from the kings of Shechem, Jerusalem, and Gezer.
Wow. So we're actually reading the mail of kings who lived during those crucial events in biblical history. That's incredible. What do the letters say?
They're full of intrigue. You'll find power struggles, pleas for help from Egyptian overlords, and even, you know, gossip about rival kings. They really paint a vivid picture of the challenges and complexities of life in the ancient Near East.
It's like eavesdropping on ancient conversations. I'm dying to know more about these Amarna letters, but I think we're going to have to save that for the next part of our deep dive.
You're right. We've covered a lot of ground already, but don't worry. We'll delve deeper into the Amarna letters and explore the rise of another powerful empire, Assyria, in the next part of our journey.
Okay. I can't wait to hear more about that. Stay tuned, everyone, for the next part of our deep dive into the fascinating world of ancient empires and their impact on the Bible. Welcome back to our deep dive into ancient empires. We left off talking about Egypt and the Amarna letters, but now I'm ready for something totally different. Let's move on to the rise of Assyria and see how this empire left its mark on the biblical world.
Prepare yourself, because Assyria was a force to be reckoned with, known for its military might, brutal tactics, and incredible palaces filled with intricate carvings. What's fascinating here is that we have so much archaeological evidence that backs up the biblical accounts.
Okay. Give me an example.
Think about the black obelisk that Dr. Houdon mentioned. This Assyrian monument shows Jehu, the king of Israel, bowing before Shalmaneser III. It's one of the earliest depictions of an Israelite king in a contemporary artistic style.
Wow. A seal mentioning Israel, that's huge. But does it actually say they were wiped out?
Well, it boasts of Merneptah's victories, including a line that reads, Israel is laid waste, his seed is no more. But historians caution us that this is likely an exaggeration, a form of boasting common in ancient victory inscriptions.
So it's more like ancient propaganda than a straightforward historical account.
Exactly. While it's likely hyperbole, it does confirm the existence of Israel as a distinct entity in Canaan during this period.
That makes sense. So getting back to the black obelisk, what else can we learn from it?
It's a powerful image that speaks volumes about the relationship between Assyria and Israel at that time. Here you have Jehu, a king in his own right, forced to submit to Assyrian authority. It's a reminder of Assyria's dominance and the lengths they went to demonstrate their power.
It must have been pretty humbling for a king to bow down like that.
Absolutely. It was a symbolic act of submission, acknowledging Assyria's superior power.
So we've got this incredible monument that captures a key moment in biblical history. What other archaeological treasures can help bring the Assyrians to life for us?
Remember those Lachish reliefs we talked about earlier, those incredibly detailed carvings that depict the Assyrian siege and destruction of the Judean city of Lachish? They provide another striking visual record of Assyrian military prowess and, unfortunately, their brutality.
It must have been terrifying to be on the receiving end of an Assyrian siege.
Absolutely. The Lachish reliefs show Assyrian soldiers storming the city walls, Judean prisoners being led away, and even scenes of torture and execution. It's horrifying to look at these images, but they give you a visceral sense of the reality of war and conquest in the ancient world.
It makes the biblical account feel much more real and immediate, doesn't it? These weren't just stories, but actual events that happened to real people.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that these events had a profound impact on the Israelites, shaping their identity and their understanding of God for generations to come.
Okay, so Assyria was clearly a major player in the ancient world, but their story isn't just about military might and brutality, right? Mm. They also had this incredible culture and left behind some amazing artifacts.
Absolutely. The Assyrians were skilled builders, artisans, and administrators. They developed sophisticated systems of governance, infrastructure, and trade. Mm-hmm. Their palaces were adorned with intricate carvings, and their libraries held vast collections of cuneiform tablets, covering everything from history and literature to science and magic.
It's amazing to think about the depth and breadth of their civilization. We mm-hmm. tend to focus on the negative aspects, but they were clearly much more than just conquerors.
That's right. It's important to acknowledge the complexities of their culture and to recognize their contributions to the ancient world.
So let's back up a bit. How did Assyria first rise to power? Where were they located?
Assyria was located in northern Mesopotamia with Nineveh as its capital. They gradually expanded their territory through military conquests, eventually controlling a vast empire stretching from Egypt to the Black Sea.
Wow, that's a huge chunk of the ancient world. When did the Israelites first encounter the Assyrians?
One of the earliest encounters we know about was during the reign of Shalmaneser III. Remember that name? He clashed with a coalition of kings, including Ahab of Israel, at the Battle of Karkar in 853 BC. Interestingly, while Shalmaneser claimed victory, it was likely a draw or even a defeat that stalled his westward expansion for a while.
So the Israelites weren't pushovers. They actually managed to hold their own against this mighty Assyrian army.
Yes, they did. It's a reminder that even the most powerful empires can be challenged. However, after Ahab's death, his successor, Jehu, chose a different path. He acknowledged Assyrian dominance and paid tribute to Shalmaneser.
So that's the context for the image on the Black Obelisk.
Precisely. It was a strategic move by Jehu to avoid further conflict with Assyria.
Okay. So even though Assyria was a powerful force, they weren't always on the offensive. Was there ever a time when their grip on power loosened?
Yes, there was. Assyria actually experienced a period of decline in the early 8th century BC, which allowed regional kingdoms like Israel and Judah to flourish and expand their borders. It's during this time that the prophet Jonah was sent to Nineveh to preach, according to the biblical account.
I never realized the story of Jonah took place during a time of Assyrian weakness.
It adds another layer of intrigue to the story, doesn't it? Imagine Jonah arriving in the heart of the Assyrian Empire at a time when their power was waning. It must have been a very different Nineveh than the one that dominated the region just a few decades earlier.
It makes you wonder how the Assyrians perceived Jonah and his message, especially during a time of uncertainty. But this period, decline, Didn't last forever, did it?
Unfortunately, no. The reign of Tiglath-Pileser III marked a resurgence of Assyrian power. He reasserted Assyrian control over the Levant, annexed parts of Israel, and made Judah a vassal state.
So he was basically saying, Assyria is back, and you're all under my thumb now.
That's a pretty accurate summary. Tiglath-Pileser III was ruthless and ambitious. He wanted to reestablish Assyria's dominance, and he wasn't afraid to use brute force to achieve his goals.
And what about his successors? Did they continue his policies?
Well, after Tiglath-Pileser III, we have Shalmaneser V, who laid siege to the Israelite capital of Samaria, but died before it fell. His successor, Sargon II, completed the conquest and deported most of the population, effectively ending Israel's existence as a unified kingdom.
Wow, that's a pretty dramatic end to a kingdom. What happened to the Israelites who were deported?
They were scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire, losing their national identity and becoming absorbed into other cultures. It was a deliberate strategy of control and assimilation by the Assyrians.
So the Assyrians weren't just content with conquering territories. They wanted to erase the cultural identities of the people they conquered. That's a pretty chilling thought.
It was a way of consolidating their power and preventing future rebellions. They believed that by breaking the connection between people and their homeland, they could create a more loyal populace.
And to be fair, it seems like it was a pretty effective strategy, though incredibly brutal.
Unfortunately, yes. The deported Israelites never truly recovered as a unified entity. Their scattering marked a turning point in their history, leading to the formation of the diaspora, which has continued to this day.
It's a powerful reminder of the lasting impact of empires and the often tragic consequences of conquest. But let's continue our journey through Assyrian history. Dr. Hudon mentioned a few other key Assyrian kings who had a significant impact on Israel and Judah. Let's start with Sennacherib. He was the one who attacked Judah in 701 BC, right?
That's right. Sennacherib was a formidable military leader, known for his ruthlessness and brutality. He boasted of destroying 46 Judean cities and deporting thousands of people. His goal was to crush any resistance to Assyrian rule.
It sounds like he was almost obsessed with crushing his enemies.
Right.
But I seem to recall that he wasn't entirely successful, right?
That's an interesting observation. You're right. While Sennacherib claimed widespread destruction in Judah, he never mentioned capturing Jerusalem. This omission is significant, and it's led to much debate among historians.
So Jerusalem remained unconquered. That seems pretty significant, especially given how determined Sennacherib was to crush any opposition.
It's a testament to the city's resilience and perhaps a sign of divine intervention. As described in the biblical account, Jerusalem, the heart of Judah, remained a symbol of defiance against Assyrian power.
That's an inspiring image. So Sennacherib's campaign was ultimately unsuccessful in capturing Jerusalem. What about the kings who came after him?
Well, after Sennacherib, we have Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal, who actually managed to expand the Assyrian Empire even further, reaching into Egypt itself. They were powerful rulers who continued the Assyrian tradition of military might and imperial expansion.
So even after setbacks like Sennacherib's failure to capture Jerusalem, Assyria continued to grow and expand its power. They were a pretty resilient empire.
Yes, they were. But their reigns also marked the beginning of Assyria's decline.
Wait, hold on. We're talking about kings who conquered Egypt. How does conquering Egypt signify decline?
Good point. Conquering Egypt was no small feat. But that victory stretched their resources thin. Remember, empires aren't just about military victories. You need a strong economic base, a stable government, and skilled administrators to maintain control of such a vast territory.
So even though Assyria was at the height of its power, the cracks were already starting to show.
Exactly. And those cracks would only widen in the years to come.
Okay, I'm ready for the final chapter of the Assyrian saga. Tell me how this mighty empire eventually crumbled.
Well, despite its military might, Assyria was built on a foundation of brutality and oppression. It had few allies and many enemies who were just waiting for the right moment to strike back.
That's something we see throughout history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Empires that are built on fear and violence rarely last. They might achieve short-term dominance, but they eventually sow the seeds of their own destruction.
That's a very insightful observation. And that's exactly what happened to Assyria. After the death of Ashurbanipal, a series of internal conflicts and rebellions weakened the empire. Their enemies, particularly the Babylonians, sensed an opportunity and formed an alliance to overthrow the Assyrians.
Okay, so we have a weakened empire and a group of rebellious subjects who are ready to break free. What happened next?
The Babylonians marched on Nineveh, and after a brutal siege, they sacked the city in 612 BC. This marked the end of the Assyrian Empire and the beginning of a new era in the ancient Near East.
Wow. What a dramatic end to a once mighty empire. From dominating the region to being conquered and their capital city sacked in just a few short years, it really shows you how quickly fortunes can change, even for the most powerful empires.
It's a reminder that even the mightiest empires are not invincible. They can be brought down by internal strife, external enemies, and perhaps even a sense of divine judgment, as suggested in some biblical interpretations.
Speaking of divine judgment, Dr. Hoonan read a powerful passage from the prophet Isaiah that describes Assyria as the rod of God's anger. How do we reconcile the brutality of empires like Assyria with the idea of a loving and just God?
It's a challenging question that has puzzled theologians and philosophers for centuries. It forces us to grapple with complex issues like free will, divine justice, and the very nature of God's relationship with humanity.
It's a lot to unpack, but maybe we can start by acknowledging that the Bible itself doesn't shy away from wrestling with these difficult questions. The prophets, for example, often challenge the actions of both the Israelites and their enemies, yeah, calling for justice and righteousness.
You are absolutely right. The biblical text is full of examples of people struggling to understand God's actions in the world, and that struggle is something that we can all relate to even today.
Okay, so we've explored the rise and fall of empires, the mysteries surrounding unidentified pharaohs, and the fascinating archaeological evidence that corroborates the biblical account. But there's one more intriguing aspect of this ancient world that I'd like to delve into. The concept of divine judgment and the role that empires played in God's plan. How do we make sense of all this?
It's a complex and often challenging topic to grapple with, but maybe we can approach it by recognizing that God works through human history, even in its darkest moments. He can use even the most flawed individuals and nations to achieve his purposes.
So perhaps the Assyrians, despite their brutality, were part of a larger plan that we can't fully comprehend. Maybe their actions, however,
yeah,
horrific, ultimately served a purpose that we can only glimpse through the lens of faith. It's definitely something to ponder.
It's a reminder that we don't always have all the answers, and that faith often requires us to trust in a power greater than ourselves, even when we don't fully understand the big picture.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. We've explored the rise and fall of both Egypt and Assyria, those incredible empires that loomed so large in the biblical world. And we've seen how archaeology can bring these ancient stories to life, allowing us to connect with the past in tangible and meaningful ways.
It's been an incredible journey through time. We've delved into the mysteries of ancient Egypt, from the grandeur of their pyramids to the intrigue surrounding the unnamed pharaohs. And we've witnessed the rise and fall of Assyria, a mighty empire built on both brilliance and brutality.
Now I'm ready to wrap up our journey through these ancient empires. We've seen their power, their influence, and their ultimate decline. But what lessons can we take away from all of this? I know I have a lot to think about.
Me too. And I'm sure you do too. So let's continue this conversation in the final part of our deep dive.
Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into the ancient Near East empires. We've journeyed through the rise and fall of both Egypt and Assyria, seeing how they shaped the biblical world, but also how their own stories ended.
It's fascinating how these once mighty empires, with all their power and influence, eventually faded from the world stage.
You know, it's kind of humbling, isn't it? It makes you realize that even the greatest empires are not immune to the passage of time.
Absolutely. It's a reminder that power is fleeting and that true greatness lies not in military might or territorial conquest, but in something more enduring.
Okay. But what does that something more enduring actually look like? What can we learn from the rise and fall of these empires? It's easy to get caught up in the drama and the intrigue, but I want to make sure we're extracting some valuable insights from all of this.
That's a great question. I think one of the most important lessons we can learn is the danger of hubris. Both Egypt and Assyria achieved incredible power and influence, but their success ultimately led to their downfall. They became arrogant, overconfident, and lost sight of the values that had initially made them strong.
Yeah, I see that. It's they got so caught up in their own power that they forgot about the needs of their people, the importance of justice and compassion.
Exactly. And as we've seen, when empires lose sight of those core values, they become vulnerable. Their people become resentful. Their enemies sense weakness, and the whole structure begins to crumble.
It's a cautionary tale for sure. It's not just about ancient history. We see this pattern repeating itself throughout history, don't we?
Absolutely. It's a timeless lesson about the importance of humility, the need to balance power with responsibility, and the recognition that that true strength lies in serving something greater than oneself.
Okay, that makes sense. But let's bring this back to the Bible for a moment. We've talked about how these empires shaped the biblical world. But how did the biblical writers view these empires?
That's another fascinating aspect of this whole story. The biblical writers viewed these empires through a very specific lens, the lens of faith. For them, Egypt and Assyria were not just political entities, but also spiritual forces representing the challenges and temptations that faced God's people.
So they weren't just writing history. They were interpreting history through the lens of their faith.
Exactly. For example, the Exodus story isn't just about the Israelites escaping from slavery in Egypt. It's also about their liberation from the spiritual bondage of idolatry and the affirmation of their covenant with Yahweh, the one true God.
So even though these empires were powerful and often oppressive, the biblical writers saw them as part of a larger divine plan.
Yes. And it's important to note that their perspective wasn't always one of simple condemnation. While they certainly recognized the brutality and injustice of these empires, they also saw them as instruments of God's judgment and ultimately as part of his plan for the redemption of his people.
That's a really interesting perspective. It's not about condoning the actions of these empires, but about recognizing that God can work through even the most difficult and challenging circumstances.
Exactly. And I think that's a powerful message of hope, not just for the ancient Israelites, but for us today as well.
Okay. So as we wrap up this incredible deep dive, I want to bring it all back to you, the listener. How has this journey changed your understanding of these ancient empires and their connection to the biblical world?
It's been quite a journey, hasn't it? We've explored the rise and fall of empires, the mysteries surrounding unidentified pharaohs, and the fascinating archaeological evidence that brings these ancient stories to life. And we've grappled with some challenging theological questions about the nature of God's relationship with humanity.
And I think the most important takeaway is that history isn't just about dates and battles. It's about people, their stories, and the enduring lessons we can learn from their experiences.
Exactly. By connecting with the past, we can gain a deeper understanding of ourselves and the world we live in today.
So as we conclude our deep dive, we encourage you to continue exploring, continue questioning, and continue seeking those hidden connections that illuminate the past and inspire us to build a better future.
Thank you for joining us on this incredible journey.
Until next time, keep diving deep.